You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Should we praise the mutilated world? Poetry from California to Krakow is our enticing and perhaps puzzling title for tonight's program, so I thought I would try and explain. A week after the September 11th attacks, The New Yorker ran Adam Zagajewski's poem, Try to Praise the Mutilated World, on its back page. And though Adam had written it a year and a half earlier, the poem sang to the heart of our collective sorrow in that troubled time, and as well to the immutable beauty of life. Andrew and I both felt, at a time when our world feels charged with uncivil discourse, that it would be an excellent moment to present these two masters of language to explore poetry's enduring inclination to marvel, and as well to honor these poets' instincts to zero in on the heart of the matter to offer sustenance. A leading critic and translator, notably of the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz and the Japanese haiku masters Basho, Busan, and Issa, Robert Haas's work speaks to us of love and loss, of the hopefulness and limitations of intimacy, and of our humanness laid bare in the midst of art, as well as the natural world and each other. His most recent essay collection, A Little Book on Form, illuminates the impulses that underlie great poetry. It's a great delight to read, and I think it's a book you'll want as part of your library. For his many books of poetry and criticism, Bob has been honored with a Pulitzer, a MacArthur Fellowship, the National Book Critics Circle Award, among many others. And as our U.S. Poet Laureate, he avidly promoted literacy and advocacy on behalf of the environment, making artistic use of his public life and setting a standard for those who followed him. I think that the job of poetry, its political job, he once commented, is to refresh the idea of justice, which is going dead in us all the time. He's a longtime professor of English at UC Berkeley. Adam Zagajewski's poems hold the mysterious glow of spring afternoons in ancient Krakow and as well the dark shadow of his country's complicated history. He was born into a mutilated world at the end of World War II in the once Polish city of Lwów, twice occupied during the war, where his family lived for generations. The titles of his collections of poetry suggest some of his concerns: Mysticism for Beginners, my favorite title, World Without End, Another Beauty. And early on in his career, he wrote poems protesting the authoritarian state. His work was banned in Poland in 1975, and he lived in exile for two decades. Adam taught at the University of Houston for many years and now teaches part of the year at the University of Chicago. And his new memoir, Slight Exaggeration, is a bricolage of memory, essay, anecdote. And as Susan Sontag once wrote, to read Zagajewski's work is to take a tour of a wonderful mind. We're delighted to have Andrew Weiner here tonight as interlocutor. Andrew is a celebrated author of the novels The Marriage Artist and The Color Midnight Made. He's the chair of creative writing at UC Riverside. And just a final note, because I think it will come up in the discussion tonight, both Bob and Adam were very close to the great poet Czesław Miłosz. And this morning, I was reading an early poem by Miłosz, and these lines struck me. When gold paint flakes from the arms of sculptures, when the letter falls out of the book of laws, then consciousness is naked as an eye. When the pages of books fall in fiery scraps onto smashed leaves and twisted metal, the tree of good and evil is stripped bare. And as we deal with looming authoritarianism from the vantage points of Krakow and California, it strikes me that this poem speaks to the tenor of the times and as well to the characteristics of both tonight's poets, the instinct to strip away the inessential, to zero in on the heart of the matter. Please welcome Adam Zagajewski, Bob Haas, and Andrew Weiner.
Good evening. I must say I stopped teaching in Chicago. Sorry for that. I should have told you, Luis. Okay, so we've been told we have 15 minutes, but then we think we have 20 minutes. I'll start with a kind of untypical poem which I wrote when we got this new government in Poland. And in a civic spirit, I wrote a poem called Some Advice for the New Government. We have a new government. Our new government includes many gifted ministers. One of our ministers speaks English. Our new government has set to work energetically. Unfortunately, it is less than aggressive in a situation permitting so many unregenerate liberals to persist. In some cities, they even outnumber traditional Catholic families. What else should our government do? It cannot be guided by the sentimental views typical of Western politicians. Some night it should execute several movie directors, not sparing women. All professors of constitutional law should be interned for life. Poets may be left in peace since no one reads them anyway. Penal camps are necessary, but they should be lenient so as not to provoke the UN. Most journalists should be sent to Madagascar. Hungary, on the other hand, should be gently removed with tongs and inserted between Poland and Germany on the map. And later, once reaction among the international Freemasonry have subsided, Germany should be surreptitiously placed between Spain and Portugal. The government of today cannot be overly scrupulous. It has been given a historic opportunity. It would be a sin not to seize it. In 2015, a very good friend of mine, wonderful American poet C.K. Williams, died. And I wrote an elegy for him after a while. Because I think poets are like artisans, and writing elegies is one of the main tasks for poets. In a way, every poem we write is an elegy for ourselves, but we also cherish our friends. This is called Charlie, in memoriam C.K. Williams. Charlie announced once in New York, we will be friends. And we were friends for 30 years. He was impatient, high-handed at times, but he understood that only kindness binds. Tall, with the face of a Spanish nobleman, he headed for his study every morning like a worker off to the vineyards, armed with great shears of imagination. He wrote slowly, revised his poems time and again, guiding a line of rapture from thickets of dense prose. He didn't seem poetic at first glance. His father sold refrigerators and TVs, but a messenger approached him, spoke in whispers. On summer vacations near Lucca, he would get up first, and in the garden, in his white djellaba from Morocco, he hunched over his black computer. His grandmother said she'd come from Austria, but she was born in Lvov. Before Ellis Island, her name had been Grabowiecka. Friendship is immortal and doesn't require many words. It's patient, calm. Friendship is the prose of love. 4 days before he died, he lay in bed, weak, wasted, like an Auschwitz prisoner with large black eyes awaiting liberation. And then I also wrote a short poem having to do with his dying. It's called CD. And Katrine is his wife. At Katrine's request, I sent Charles a CD then. It held Bach's Chaconne, Beethoven's Piano Sonata Opus 132, and Chopin's Scherzos. Pretty much the music you would take to a desert island, assuming the island had something to play it on. He listened to the disc in his last days, and maybe he thought about how he was leaving that wealth, the happiness that lies hidden in even the saddest largo. So these are new poems, and all translated by Clare Kavanagh. Another life. You like living through biographies. There you are in another life. How strange, how startling to turn up in the dark woods of another life. But you can leave at any moment, for the street or the park, or at night from the balcony. You like to see the stars belonging to no one, stars like knives that wound us without a drop of blood, stars pure and shining, heartless. I've written in the recent years a few poems about my mother, who died many years ago, but I needed time to talk about her. So this is this poem called Public Speaking Contest. Or when she told us, for the 10th time maybe, about the public speaking contest that, as a young law student, she had won, nearly won, even though she faced serious competition, and like everyone else, was stunned that a woman had won, nearly won, and not a man, a future judge or lawyer. She came out the best, nearly the best, though technically speaking, someone else took home first prize. And that was her greatest success. And when we listened to her story later, much later, ironically, a little bored, thinking, you're still caught up in a competition, invisible this time, like most such occupations, and you want us to give the laurels that they refused you then. And how I wish I could hear her tell the story again, about the contest she nearly won, and in which, I think, after decades of her memory's unceasing labor, she finally carried the day. Well, you know, I've only 20 minutes, and I flew over the ocean to come here. So. It makes me nervous. So this is a poem called Nocturne. Sunday afternoons, September. My father listens to a Chopin concerto, distracted. Music for him often was just a backdrop for other activities, work or reading. But after a moment, he puts the book aside, lost in thought. I think one of the nocturnes must have moved him deeply. He looks through the window. He doesn't know I'm watching. His face opens to the music, to the light. And so he stays in my memory, focused, motionless. So he will remain always beyond the calendar, beyond the abyss, beyond the old age that undid him. And even now, when he no longer is, he's still here, attentive, book to one side, leaning in his chair, serene. He listens to Chopin as if that nocturne were speaking to him, explaining something. So one more elegy. This is an elegy for a lady who was our neighbor in Krakow. Her name was Ruth Buczyńska. She survived the war in Ternopil, in darkness and in semi-darkness, in fear. She was afraid of rats and heavy boots, loud conversations, screams. She died just now in darkness in a hospital ward's white quiet. She was a Jew. Sometimes she didn't know what that meant. It's simple and incomprehensible, like algebra. At times she tried to work it through. The Gestapo knew exactly what it meant to be a Jew. The great philosophical tradition helped. Definitions sharp as knives, direct as a Buddhist arrow. She was beautiful. She should have died then, like the other men and women, vanished without a trace, gone without elegies, like so many others, like the air. But she lived a long time in daylight, in the sun, in the daily air, the oxygen of ordinary Krakow. Sometimes she couldn't understand what it meant to be beautiful. The mirror kept still. It didn't know the philosophical definitions. She didn't forget those other times, but hardly ever spoke of them. Once only she told this story. Her beloved cat wouldn't stay in the ghetto. Twice it went back to the Aryan side at night. Her cat didn't know who Jews were, what the Aryan side meant. It didn't know, so it shot to the other side like an arrow. Ruth was a lawyer and defended others. Maybe that was why she lived so long, because there are so many others and they need defending. Prosecutors multiply like flies, but the defenders are few. She was a good person. She had a soul. We seem to know what that means. I'm looking at my watch. I'm in the middle of the ocean now, isn't it? I have too many new poems. There'll be a new book in November called Asymmetry. So another poem about my mother. I could never say anything about my mother, how she repeated, "You'll regret it one day when I'm not around anymore," and how I didn't believe in either I'm not or anymore. How I liked watching as she read bestsellers, always turning to the last chapter first. How in the kitchen, convinced it's not her proper place, she made Sunday coffee or even worse, fillet of cod. How she studied the mirror while expecting guests, making the face that best kept her from seeing herself as she was. I take after her in this and other failings. How she went on at length about things that weren't her strong suit, and how I stupidly teased her. For example, when she compared herself to Beethoven going deaf, and I said cruelly, but you know, he had talent. And how she forgave it all, and how I remember that, and how I flew from Houston to her funeral, and they showed a comedy in flight, and I wept with laughter and grief, and how I couldn't say anything, and still can't. There's now a poem which I did teach in Chicago, the University of Chicago. You know, it's in Hyde Park, right? And in Hyde Park, they say, the students from other colleges say they're a little jealous of the university, and they say that the University of Chicago is where fun comes to die. And they have, you know, T-shirts. So this poem's called Nowhere. It was a day nowhere after I came back from my father's funeral, a day between two continents. I was lost, and I walked in the streets of Hyde Park, listening to scraps of American voices. I didn't belong anywhere. I was free. But if this was freedom, I thought, I would probably prefer to be a good king's, a decent emperor's prisoner. Leaves were floating against the stream of the red fall. Wind was yawning like a foxhound. A cashier in a grocery store nowhere asked me, "Where are you from?" But I forgot. I wanted to tell her about my father's death, but I thought, I might be a bit too old for an orphan. I was in Hyde Park, nowhere, where fun comes to die, as students of other colleges claimed, not without envy. It was a Monday, a day with no character, a coward, formless, a day without inspiration, nowhere. Even grief was not at its most radical. It seemed to me that Chopin himself on a day like this would decide at the most to give lessons to his wealthy aristocratic disciples. Suddenly I remembered what Gottfried Benn, a Berlin dermatologist, wrote about him in one of my favorite poems. Quote, "When Delacroix expounded his theories, it made him nervous. He, for his part, could offer no explanation of his nocturnes." End of quote. These lines, ironic and tender at the same time, always provided me with a moment of happiness almost as great as Chopin's music itself. This one I knew. Also, night didn't need an explanation, nor pain, nowhere. I'll end with a poem I read in both languages. Maybe there's some compatriots here who like the sound of our beautiful language. I think the plane has sort of reached the Labrador now, so I can. So I'll read in English first. And then in Polish. Shell. At night, the monks sang softly, and a gusting wind lifted spruce branches like wings. I've never visited the ancient cities. I've never been to Thebes or Delphi, and I don't know what the oracle once told travelers. Snow filled the streets and canyons, and crows in dark robes silently trailed the fox's footprints. I believed in elusive signs, in shadowed ruins, water snakes, mountain springs, prophetic birds. Linden trees bloomed like brides, but their fruit was small and bitter. Wisdom can be found in music or fine paintings, in great deeds, courage, even love, but only in all these things, in earth and air, in pain and silence. A poem may hold the thunder's echo like a shell touched by Orpheus as he fled. Time takes life away and gives us memory, gold with flame, black with embers. Muszla. W nocy mnisi cicho śpiewali, a porywisty wiatr unosił gałęzie świerków jak skrzydła. Nie poznałem starożytnych miast, nie byłem nigdy w Tebach ani w Delfach i nie wiem, co mówiły Sybille wędrowcom. Śnieg zasypywał ulice i wąwozy i bezszelestnie śladami lisa kroczyły ciemne suknie wron. Ufałem ulotnym sygnałom, cieniom ruin, wężom wodnym, górskim źródłom i proroczym ptakom. Nie w muzyce, ani w pięknych obrazach, nie w wielkich czynach i odwadze, i nawet nie w miłości jest mądrość, tylko we wszystkich rzeczach, w ziemi i w powietrzu, w bólu i w milczeniu. Wiersz potrafi zatrzymać echo burzy, jak muszla, którą potrącił uciekający Orfeusz. Czas zabiera życie i oddaje pamięć, złotą od płomieni, czarną od żaru. Thank you.
I love Adam's poems, and I have since, it must have been the mid-1980s that a mutual friend started sight translating some of the poems for me on a summer afternoon in Berkeley, one poem after another that was amazing. So it's an honor to be here reading with Adam. I took the assignment to address the question, should we praise the mutilated world literally in my way? And I thought, not can we, must we, but should we? It made it seem like a moral question. And I realized that in thought about Adam's early poems at a time when, a time of solidarity, when young poets in Poland were writing ironic poem about the language of politics. Renata Gorczynski, in a summer garden, read to me these poems in which Adam looked at the painfulness and horror of the world and wrote gorgeous poems about music. And that's as a way of wrestling with what that thing proposes, which is the nature of evil. Anyway, when I looked at the poems I tried to write on this subject, I realized they were all in a file called Not Quite There. So that's pretty much what you're going to get. This poem comes from reading a book, an amazing and difficult book. As the Russian army advanced on Berlin in 1945, I don't know how many Russian soldiers dead at that point in the passage, 4 or 5 million. And they saw the way that Germans were living compared to the poverty in which they were living. And when they arrived in Berlin, they were feeling such rage that the officers let them go. And for about 3 weeks to a month, they systematically raped every woman in Berlin, every grandmother, every girl child in the city. It was one of the great shames of the end of the war, and no one could speak of it. And one young woman kept a journal of called Four Weeks in a Conquered City. It's been translated into English. I read it. And it posed that question, should we praise the mutilated world in the sharpest way? The poem is called Winged and Acid Dark. What occurred to me waking was a sentence with dappled shadow in it. Something not sayable, spurting from the morning silence, secret as a thrush. The other man, the officer who brought onions and wine in sacks of flour, the major with the swollen knee, wanted intelligent conversation afterward. Having no choice, she provided that too. Potsdamer Platz, May 1945. When the first one was through with her, he pried her mouth open. Basho told Rensetsu to avoid sensational materials in poetry. If the horror of the world were the truth of the world, he said, there would be no one to say it, and no one to say it to. I think he recommended describing the slightly frenzied swarming of insects near a waterfall. Pried her mouth open and spit in it. We pass these things on, probably because we are what we can imagine. Something not sayable but wanting to be said in the morning silence, the mind hungering after likenesses, tender sky, it wants to say, curves the swallows trace in air. So, that's an old poem wrestling with. Here's some of these. This one is called John Muir, A Dream, A Waterfall, A Mountain Ash. I had been given two pieces of writing to read which had been judged somehow to be of special excellence in the dream. One was a description of my childhood kitchen in the house in San Rafael. You could feel in the common, orderly description some animal thing trapped there, pushing out frantically against the walls. The other piece of writing contained a small door you had to stoop to climb through. It led to the ridge of a canyon from which you could look down into an orchard. I knew it was Canyon de Chelly. I knew Kit Carson and his scouts would be coming to burn the village and destroy the fruit trees which were neatly aligned along irrigation ditches that the Spanish would call acacia, and I woke feeling nauseated. Outside, the immense Sierra dark and silence, the motor of the fan pulsing cool air, a sky still glittering with a strew of stars, faint rose brightening to the east. You'd think past 60 or so, the unconscious mind would give you some respite. But here, it says, is the little engine of dread and sorrow that runs your story. And here, almost symmetrical, is the unspeakable cruelty of the world. In an hour, I can drive through sugar pines to the market in Tahoma, get coffee, get a paper. The plan today is to climb Ellis Peak to see if we can't find the cluster of golden berries on the mountain ash that we saw last year when the slope of the mountain flattens and the creek runs in a silvery sheet across slabs of granite and then flares into a series of cascades, spumes of white water leaping down the canyon in what John Muir thought was joy or its simulation, a good walk, mostly uphill. We wear ourselves out with it. This is called Nature Notes. Epigraph from Gary Snyder, two seedling fir, one died, Eo, Eo, the opening of his wonderful poem, Myths and Texts. one brown-headed cowbird among the blackbirds in their iridescent breeding plumage. Can't mate, but there's safety in a flock. The morning air is all awash in angels, that is, seeds of the cottonwood drifting in the sun, the bits of cottony fluff floating on the mild morning breeze and tumbling a little in the currents of it, hundreds of them, thousands that the sun ignites, brightening the air above a drab blackbird juvenile, its mouth open so wide you can see the sunset orange of its throat, and an adult bird ambulates over in that blackbird Egyptian frieze strut and pops something in its mouth, a bit of worm, I presume, or a shiny little beetle going about its shiny beetle business until a moment ago. People study everything, the excrement of beetles, the sonic niches of the blackbird's song, and the sexual excesses of the cottonwood which pours thousands of seeds into the air. So I know that for one to germinate, it has to alight in moist, sandy soil. A sandbar in the curve of a little alpine creek would be just right. It's a very slim chance. So the trees only persist because they are extravagant. The liver-colored mushrooms under the pines are the fruiting bodies of fungi that send their roots fairly deep into the earth where they devour nematodes, microscopic animals like worms. Humans study everything to feed themselves. Don't know what the nematodes eat, but it must be eating all the way down until it becomes electricity and tingles to be tingling. The morning air is all awash in angels. Information from a morning lecture. We've gotten so good at getting soldiers' bodies from the battlefield of the hospital that a soldier can lose both legs and an arm and survive writing notes to the nurses because his throat is also ripped out. The pond is reflecting bankside willows. The breeze rustles the willow branches, ruffles the surface of the water, and produces a dark green, light green, willowy wash of yellow-green watercolor across the pond underneath the dazzled air. Poet I know loved her alcoholic uncle who didn't take care of himself and died too young. He was the one, she said, who saw her, saw who she was, and loved her. She wrote some lines about this first adult sadness. It's her way of coming to poetry. He was an intense reader of astronomy, this sweet man who wrecked himself, who seemed not to be able to do anything about it. She watched him die, loved him helplessly. A poet's task to find the words, she said, though perhaps by writing about something else. So this is pertinent divagations toward an ode to Inuit carvers. It's this same deal. Because it resembles, and what figures in it? Oh, the wonderful, really great Mexican poet Pura Lopez Colomé makes a guest appearance in this poem. Because it resembles the sphere, meaning a figure on which every point of its surface is equally distant from its center, but is a physical object, not a sphere, because as a practical matter, an actual physical object cannot be constructed, which has a surface every point of which is equidistant from its center. Pablo Neruda may have missed an opportunity in failing to address an ode to the softball. Ah, sexual moon of summer nights, the something to hit that initiates an intricate ballet of chance and rule-governed behavior on summer afternoons. And for that matter, he missed the soccer ball, known in the civilized world as football, which may have been, as a thought, more culturally available. And Octavio Paz, why did you keep your silence on the almost perfectly round stones that are still to be found lying around ball courts in Aztec ruins? Hot day, tar and vanilla scent of dry summer grasses, blue-bellied lizards so still on the stone walls they seem to be listening to the roar of crowds from Montezuma's last weeks diminishing in the distance like a train whistle. And Pura Lopez, you were wrong to repose in the journalist bar in Mexico City after everyone had had lunch and a couple of caballitos, meaning little horses, meaning shots of tequila served in tiny ceramic cups, the blue color of melancholy when it's just begun to turn the corner and get a hold on itself. that women only like baseball on television and ballparks because the uniforms made men's butts look like pleasant objects of contemplation. Even the women at our table were outraged by this suggestion, and it's no wonder writers don't get much done after 3 o'clock in Mexico City. And that night, when the weather had cooled Pura, her crinkly black hair cut boyishly, the shiny and almost perfectly round brown irises of her eyes lifted to heaven, singing the soprano part in the Palestrina motet in an almost intimate Baroque church in Cuernavaca, not a trace of irony in her gamins or angel gamins' face. This could be the preface to an ode circumambulating the softball or the polyphonies of Palestrina. Almost perfect is the theme. If Plato could have had his way, the earth would have been a sphere instead of almost a sphere. There would probably not be a wobble in its rotation and hence no ice age. And how would you get through the interminable afternoons in fourth grade if there were no pictures of woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers as object of pleasant contemplation in geography books? And while we are on the subject, if you notice that there are never any pictures of ice age dinosaurs, that this is a profoundly tropical normative representation of their earthly domain in all the textbooks. Ice age reptiles. We have wandered far from our subject, have we not? Or not? Think of the whiteness of the softball. Think about politics. Imagine a world in which dental and medical care for children were so completely available that all adults in both hemispheres had, at least in their 20s and 30s, almost perfectly white teeth. It implies, doesn't it, a completely different distribution of wealth. That's my point. We are governed by ice age reptiles. What if the cycles of oil wars were over and the undistribution of automatic weapons had commenced and the wars of distributive vengeance withered away and the insurrection against grasping dictatorial power rendered irrelevant? Everyone could be playing softball or watching people in interesting uniforms playing softball. It's only a pop-up, an almost perfectly white day moon of an almost perfectly spherical softball looping through the blue summer air as if it were some sublimely graceful ice age sea creature riding the ocean of the air. And she's underneath it, looking up almost as if she were singing a Palestrina motet, the one in which the angel tells the young woman she is full of grace. The whole spectatorial world has assembled, leaning forward, sipping beer or not, sipping tequila or not, sipping an as yet to be invented ginger and anise flavored beverage concoction that our endlessly inventive kind has not yet devised, but with pleasant and familiar fizziness imparted to the nostrils. No one knows yet whether she'll catch it. She doesn't know, but this is a poem in praise of imperfection, freedom from fear, freedom from violence, and smiles the almost perfect white of the new tusks of an unmolested walrus pup. This is a poem to old Eskimos and the tools they fashioned to fashion dolphins leaping from the pale, lovely umber, formerly white, of old ivory. So that took 15 minutes. And I was not going to read this, but Adam read these elegies, and I have a poem. So I'll read two more poems. This is poem, not an elegy, in a season of elegies. It was around the time that, just before Charlie died, there were several other deaths of people dear to me. One of them was the poet Galway Connell. Another was the novelist Oakley Hall. Another was old friend Mark Strand. And our contemporary brilliant Slovene poet Tomas Salomon. And then my father-in-law died. And it seemed too soon to write an elegy about him, so this is poem, not an elegy, in a season of elegies. My father-in-law was an economist and grew up on a subsistence farm in Mississippi, became a prominent international economist. And I visited with him the coast of southern Portugal, where he had done work for the Green Revolution. Poem, not an elegy in a season of elegies. They built shallow ponds in the wetlands all along the Mediterranean shore to rot fish in and make a condiment. It has a name, which escapes me. 2,000 years after, there was a trail through the checkerboard of levees made by the dikes, star thistle and artichoke thistle edging them in southern Portugal one summer. I jogged early before the onset of the god's anvil of the heat of mid-July, beach in the distance where the Romans must have hauled their triremes up. There was a slight breeze off the sea, and down the shore, a flock of flamingos browsing the marsh, and in a pine above the golf course, a nesting stork. Galway was alive then, and I think Oakley was alive then. Jimmy Hillman was alive then, and the occasion for my being there, saying to myself and to Thomas Schalemann, who was alive then, and probably in Ljubljana, but there were occasions when I spoke to him despite his absence, and this was one of them. Thomas once owned a boat in Dubrovnik, was partners in a boat, which I had the impression they leased to smugglers who brought in costume jewelry from department stores in Italy to avoid customs and peddled in the morning market in the square in Ljubljana, or sold to the women's accessory buyers for the department stores who got a piece of the markup. This to be taken with a grain of salt or a dollop of fermented fish sauce, garum, that's the Latin name. Since I didn't hear the story from Thomas and was more or less drunk when I heard it from someone else, part of the Shalamunian legend. Thomas, I said, weaving my way among the salt ponds. I'm weaving my way among salt ponds. Outside Pharaoh, ancient Roman salt ponds, still almost intact. There are guys harvesting clams just down the shore and a flock of blush-colored intertidal birds not even a technicolor Giacometti could have invented. And there is a stork nesting in a tree on the golf course. I have no idea what storks mean to Europeans. In some of the picture books of my childhood, they built nests in chimneys, which gave the villages a sleepy, peaceful look. Since we're the same age, you must have also sucked your thumb and studied pictures of storks dozing in twiggy nests in a Europe where not much of anything happened as your mother turned the pages. That's what I would say. Sitting nests, these creatures for 50 million years. Thomas, I remember your saying that in your opinion, all bakers should be taught to sing. It stands to reason, I think you said, and I was impressed that you had mastered that English idiom. Of course we stand to reason and lie down to dream. It would have made dough rise to have the bakers singing. Thomas, they should have lit fires in little paper boats in the harbor at Dubrovnik when you died and sent them out glittering on the bay. When Galway died, the earth should have groaned. It should have loosed lions in the civil streets. When Mark Strand died, the stars should have traded small ironic witticisms in a language wholly unintelligible to us, but glittering. For Oakley, we should have decommissioned every dam on the Colorado and floated a sleek white kayak through all its turnings from above Glen Canyon to the Gulf, trailing after it the long self-erasing sentence of a silver wake, and thrown a party somewhere on the Baja shore. No metaphors yet for my father-in-law. He still, in my head, belongs to life. Vigorous, generous man, hungry for the world at 93. That summer in Faro, he was showing his children a world he'd come to love. He was a farm boy from the pine woods of southeast Mississippi. Came to be a man who loved this world. Loved speaking Portuguese, walking his sons and daughters through the ramparts of old fortresses and the mosques of the Algarve. He was a little amused by our interest in cuisines, having grown up on grits and red-eye gravy, because that was what there was on a depression farm in Mississippi in 1933, and because one of his earliest memories was the odor of his father and brother rinsing excrements from the guts of a slaughtered pig. He was, as an old man, mad about writing, and he'd written about that smell and the squealing and the blood, but he knew the restaurants in Faro where branzino was roasted whole and stuffed with rice and raisins and something they did with lemon, cinnamon, and garlic. He's dead now 3 weeks. By the time we left the table, he knew the names of the four children, the waitress, and the ages of the children. This was after he had ordered coffee for us and the beautiful green pears the Arabs 1,400 years ago had brought from Damascus to plant in all Andalus. So in the spirit of praising the mutilated world, I'll read one more poem, but this one requires audience participation. I'll tell you the title, and then you have to say it rapidly three times. Okay, deal? So the title is The Six Sheikhs' Sheep's Sick. Can you do it? The Six Sheikhs' Sheep's Sick. The Six Sheikhs' Sheep's Sick. The Six Sheikhs' Sheep's Sick. Praise to the teeth and the lips and the breath. Praise to the tongue and to the larynx and the pharynx and the soft palate and the hard palate and the vibration of the vocal cords. Peter Piper picked a peck of seashells by the seashore. Peter Piper picked up seashells by the seashore. She sells rubber baby buggy bumpers. Sells rubber baby buggy bumpers. It's early March, late afternoon. There's one tiny tufted titmouse in the bare branches of the sycamore just outside my window. The loudest and the smallest of all the spring birds. Its eye the size of a single black currant. Three sweet notes, perfectly spaced. And then sometimes four. Not difficult to say, one tiny tufted titmouse. One tiny tufted titmouse. But it requires a small increment of effort. And in the bare branches of the sycamore, in the bare branches of the sycamore, is pure pleasure. When I read my poems aloud, I find it's hard to say that the people stand on tiptoe to pick ripe huckleberries that the deer can't reach. Stand on tiptoe to pick ripe huckleberries that the deer can't reach. Pick ripe huckleberries. Aluminum linoleum. The round leaf buds on the tips of the branches of the sycamore are glowing gold in the afternoon sun. Three sweet notes again. It wants a mate. Maybe. Maybe it's just playing. Researchers have taught chimps over 100 words, and the books say they can't use them to form new concepts. She sells pickled peppers. She sells pickled peppers. Three notes again, but can't doesn't seem just right. What if it's just not in the range of the things the chimps feel like doing? I want to say ripe huckleberries. Ripe. The titmouse flits from branch to branch. The titmouse flits from branch to branch. Because I want to. Praise to the breath and the teeth and the lips. Praise to the tongue and to the animal who first said pharynx. And to the one who first larynx, praise. Well, thank you very much. And now we over here.
It's a real honor to be on the stage with you two. I've lived with both of your poems for many years and have been in conversation with them. So thank you for coming, and thank you, Adam, for coming so far to be here. And thank you all for coming tonight to share in this. And I want to thank Louise for being the one person probably in Los Angeles who understands what it means when someone like Adam flies all the way from Krakow to Southern California, and why we should do something like this. So thank you. You two have someone in common, who was mentioned earlier, the poet Czesław Miłosz, a great Lithuanian Polish poet. And I'm kind of hoping that before the night is over, you'll both share maybe an anecdote about Miwosh. But by way of asking my first question, I wanted to just read an excerpt from one of Miwosh's poems. The poem is Throughout Our Lands. If I had to tell what the world is for me, I would take a hamster or a hedgehog or a mole and place him in a theater seat one evening, and, bringing my ear close to his humid snout, would listen to what he says about the spotlights, sounds of the music, and movements of the dance. I guess I wanted to ask you both, can we grasp ordinary experience, or is there something nameless about everyday reality? And if the latter is true, does a kind of not knowing inform your days and your poetry?
Let's go alphabetically.
So this made me, I'll come to that question, but it made me think of a question that I didn't know, which is when Adam was beginning to write poems, Czesław could not be in Poland and could not be read in Poland. So I no longer remember when you first met him.
I met him in Paris in 83.
And who was he to you then?
Oh, he was... I discovered him not when I was 15 or 16, because he was totally hidden by the communist government. I discovered him when I was 21 or 22. And he was, for me, a great poet, great poet. So when I finally met him in Paris after many years of reading him, as you know, we don't need to meet great poets. It's enough to read them. So, but it's okay to meet them. Yeah, he was, you know how he was, right?
So... I had been, Czesław was my neighbor, and at some point in the late 70s, I started working with him a little bit on the translation of his poems. That is, I was basically kind of depolonizing his translations of the of the poems. And then at a certain point, he won the Nobel Prize, and everybody then wanted the poems and went to work on them, some of the early ones and other ones. And I was feeling very dubious about this thing of work. I was in the process of not learning Japanese, so I didn't want to start not learning Polish. And I was just amazed by some of these poems that he was written when he was very young. And I was dying to know of a Polish person that I could ask about this. And when Adam and I finally met, almost the first thing I said to you was, you know this poem, Song, he wrote it when he was 23 years old. It's a staggeringly great poem. Am I right? I mean, I don't know the Polish. And Adam said, it's an amazing poem, and you'd never know that he was so young, except for the gauche rhyme at the end. And I thought, I will never know what a gauche rhyme is in Polish. You know, I kind of do. You kind of know when Robert Frost is being cornball. You know, you can tell. But that thing, it takes a poet in the language. Anyway, my story about our first meeting.
I'll try to answer your question, but first with the anecdote. Well, it's a very strange, and this was late in his life, and I was in Houston, I was teaching in Houston, must have been late 90s, and he called me once, and he was depressed, and he said, Adam, please tell me, have I ever written a good poem in my life? And this was a poet who was, after the Nobel Prize, was this universal acclaim. And what could I say? I thought, you know, you are a great poet. But I knew it wouldn't help, because if you're depressed, what does it mean when someone tells you you're a great poet? So it's for me a great lesson of humility. But trying to answer your question about the... I like these lines from Throughout Our Land. I think they... It's always... I like in poetry... There's this, what you say, it's the, we don't, poetry comes from not knowing and from knowing. They're the two things that come together. Poets are usually educated, well-educated people, mostly more than painters or, I don't want to offend any painters, but there's some very educated painters, though.
A few. There are a few.
You asked two questions, and the second one is the profound one that I don't know. But he loved reading that passage about being a hedgehog looking in the theater, looking at the light, because it presented him. It's a charming poem.
Yeah.
And when he wanted to charm an audience, he would read that poem. But in fact, he was tormented by the question of whether experience can be represented.
Yeah.
And at the end of that particular poem, he is identified with Cabeza de Vaca, having walked naked across the continent from Louisiana to Mexico. And he said what he really ought to do while everybody's eating their meals is get down on all fours and go, whoa, 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 I think is how the poem ends. Mm-hmm. So whether... And which, in his particular way of doing, also had to do with the problem of evil, with the passage that Louise read when the tree of good and evil is stripped bare. Yeah. He asked that. It's going into that territory is one of the things that, one of the places where he's really great. Mm. And that. But the second formulation of, is there some not knowing?
Well, is not knowing kind of an active, almost an activity for you, you see? But don't worry if you can.
Yeah, no, I'm very curious about... And I was just reading a blurb from... somebody gave in a book of your prose and describing your ability to continue to feel wonder, which... is wonder maybe a form of not knowing?
I think it's this. It's the two things at the same. It's this erudition and a feel of total helplessness in the face of the world, which is, I think, poetry comes more out of not knowing than of knowing, and out of amazement, of astonishment. Of course. And I think poets are not specialists. Like, poet is the opposite of a specialist. Mm-hmm. One of the things of the poetic language is that it's never a jargon. Doctors write in jargon, physicists write in jargon, literary critics write in most in horrible jargon. not all of them. You know.
How many critics in the audience?
Some are just leaving.
What about philosophers?
About what?
Philosophers.
Well, that's the same, you know. When you read Heidegger, who had this great intuition, but then he coined so many horrible notions. And it's like philosophers are like blind people who see something and they create these categories that have no relationship to reality.
So what does a poet do if the poet is also blind, proceeding semi-blindly? What's the different move there?
I'm also thinking of the poem Incantation by Chekhov, which talks about poetry, and it's something companion philosophia in the service of the good. Yeah. He very much wanted to think that they were not diametrically opposite enterprises in the way that reason versus feeling or something like that. He thought that that they both had the job to do, and the difference probably was that was poetry. Though he was never satisfied, he would never have been satisfied to say not knowing is what poetry does. He desperately wanted to know.
Yeah.
And the torment of his poetry and the power of it is in that desperation to know.
But in a way, what poets write all these manifestos, but who cares? You know? I think poets have too much time because, as the prose writers say, at 9 a.m., the poet is already done. And what they do after 9, they write manifestos. there's no relationship between the poetry or the pure moment of inspiration, of awe, or sadness. And then manifestos, they try to imitate philosophers, but you shouldn't read these things. You know, right? Well, maybe with a few exceptions.
Is your book, the latest book, a manifesto?
No, it's
not. But in both of your poems, there's a sense of wonder at being alive, but also terror, I think. Would you say that that poetry, or that you and your work try to nevertheless, I mean, is there a conciliatory aspect to your work or to poems? Can poems be conciliatory? Do they affirm the world as it is? Or do they remake the world in a form that might have better values attached to it?
Alphabetic.
I mean, after September 11th, 2001, not long after Adam's poem appeared in the New Yorker, and with the title was "How to Praise or Should We Praise the
Try to Praise
the Mutilated World?" And it's a serious question, you know, whether you should or not.
Can I say this? That it seems to me the danger in affirming the world as it is, praising it as it is that it puts you in this position almost of colluding with the mutilators, in a sense, right? There's that.
Yeah, and the poem of protest against it can engage the same force. I have a 3-page rant on the history of the AK-47. I thought, I'll read that. And partly I feel like I don't even want to enlist that energy, you know? So with praise the mutilated world, there's a haiku I'll just say, a haiku of Issa, naked on a naked horse in pouring rain. Period. Poetry, you know. Or even with insects, some can sing, some can't. You know, he just did these small things. My neighbor, in deep autumn, how does he live, I wonder? Just, there's poem after poem that just goes...
Yeah.
And then there is this... there is this problem of evil, and how you respond to it. And
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge subject, right? And we have another 15 minutes. I think that it can easily be said that there are many poets or writers who certainly condemn the world in a kind of outright way, with irony, but on the other side, it's not affirmation, it's a mix of everything. It's not so that there are writers or poets who condemn the world, and on the other side are those who praise the world all the time. Praising the world is always mixed with lament, and it's there's no symmetry here.
I've heard people say that interesting poems almost say the opposite of what they're saying. It's one way of, and another way of I've heard it said is that a poem that affirms the world has to have a powerful negation in it. Mm. And a world that negates the world has to have a power affirmation, powerful. The one is cynical without it, and the other is sentimental without it. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know if this is true, but someone told me that two young men came to Giverny to be with Monet and describe what it was like in the trenches. Shit. Dead horses, dead people crawling over corpses. The horror of that war. And he got up the next morning and went down and started painting the water lilies in anger. And it explained to me why those paintings aren't wallpaper.
Yeah.
Why their beauty is breathtaking, because he had swallowed all that darkness before he made astonishing beauty.
So let me ask you this. One impulse of poems is this kind of almost innocence where you are, the great art critic Shklovsky said, you need to look at the world through an estranged eye, mm-hmm. right? As if you're seeing it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to say something?
No, just to say that was, for me, the gift of Adam's early poems, exactly that. Mm.
Yeah. And then there's this another strain, which I think is in both of your poems, which is poems that feel the weight of history, of vanished experience, of memory, of what we've lost. I wonder if those two kind of impulses inform your kind of attempts to wrestle with the world that we, the historical world, the one that Luis alluded to, mm-hmm. our moment now, mm-hmm. Moments like Adam was talking about in World War II, but also to wrest a particle from something more eternal, mm-hmm. I guess, from being something outside of time.
Mm-hmm. Your questions are becoming more and more difficult.
I'll get easier after.
No. Well, after will be dinner, I guess. I don't know. I think it's very hard to delimitate these things so clearly. Where you face evil, you're amazed too. And when you face beautiful day in the meadow, you're amazed too. So I really don't know. And you never know what the next poem will be, mm-hmm. although it's probably similar to the poem before. But in your soul, you always think the next day you'll see something new, and you'll find an answer to. I believe in a search for something that's hidden, and I don't know what it is, and it's partly religious, maybe not religious, but I believe in this quest. But mm. I hate defining this quest.
Yeah, it's horrible to talk about, isn't it? In some ways, and here we are talking about it, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so how about a simpler question? I guess I wanted to ask both of you the inverse question, which is, Adam, how did coming to America kind of change or affect your work? And I wanted to ask you, Robert, how did your kind of interactions with Czesław and with people like Adam and your kind of interfacing with this other world affect your work?
Well, when I came to America to teach in Houston, I wasn't a baby, so I already had, I think, my world and was already there. Mm. I found in America many friends, and I found friendship. For me, America is the land of friendship. I came from Paris, which is very difficult for friendships. You know, it's a Parisians are very cautious, and they don't easily. So it was a huge encouragement for me to come. It was still not more in terms of energy, of seeing, of finding a continent where some people were fascinated by poetry, and I couldn't find it in Paris so easily. So I don't think in intellectual terms it was a revelation. It was more a revelation in psychological, in anthropological terms.
But I mean, even when you found yourself in Houston, in this such a different place, I mean, was there this something about the how un-Krakow-like it was, or you know, or about the distance from your entire kind of, because Paris is obviously closer to Poland. Is there something about being in a place like Houston that gave you perhaps more of a clarity about some of the things you were already writing about?
Maybe, yeah. But when you're Houston, especially in the beginning, was totally strange to me and unfamiliar. So I don't hate Houston. I like this place, and I found friends there. And in a strange places, you are closer to your inner world. So in a way, you maybe easier to write poems in strange places and in your familiar places, because then the contrast between what is inside you and what's outside it's good. It helps you.
Yeah. Robert, did you want to say?
Yeah, I had worked on Milos's poems for like 25 years, poems written from the 1930s to the 2000s. So that, just without my intending to, occupy a lot of, I put time into that. And I was, Seamus Heaney said there are two attitudes toward translation, and they correspond to the two Viking relations to Ireland, the settlement and the raid. And that he had been a raider, and I definitely, without quite having intended it to happen, had to settle with Chesov. And Adam and I belong to the generation for whom the background of the Tolkien novels, the Great War, and that great horror was there, and we were epigones of that. Mm. I don't know if you have that feeling or not, the wake of that. And he was one of, but there was for a whole range of European poets, for me, Sepharis and Grieg and Montali, and Brecht, who were information about what seemed like the great moral struggle of that preceded our time of life, and cast backward on it. So that was kind of amazing and thrilling to me to get to do that. I don't know if it, and of course the work you study opens up the possibilities, the possible moves you can make. I'm sure it's true writing fiction as well, that you've learned places that you can go.
From
what you've read. So part of it was friendship, social relations, this long, deep, complicated friendship on the one hand, and then the experience of other cultures. But for me, as much studying Japanese or reading Neruda or Vallejo as Polish poetry was a way of being able to see my world a little bit from outside it.
Yeah. I'd like to kind of end it on the title of our talk in a way, And I wondered how kind of called each of you feel to respond to some of the currents in our in our world now, culturally, the nationalisms that are afoot on both sides of the Atlantic, as poets and otherwise.
That's difficult.
As a person, as a human being, I'm appalled by the rise of populism.
I say I'm appalled by the rise of the kind of oblivion what fascism was, and the fascism is coming back, not as yet, not so strongly as in the 30s, but the, like the oblivion of people that is so terrible, and yet I don't think I should just drop everything else and write about it in my poem. So I try to be alert, and I write some. I've written some articles, but it's a question: what to do? Is it? Yeah. I don't have an answer. I read this one poem, this one satirical poem. I wouldn't like to turn into a satirical poet right at my age. It's a little late, so but to be alert, to know it, and to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Miłosz and his responses almost right away, back after the war, right? And then all throughout his life, really, he looks back, and so there's something about the ability to look back and process with some time that obviously must help the poet to actually make poems out of out of such things. At any rate. Robert, do you?
I think I have one poem that goes something like the old mahogany chair by the window, annoyingly glowing during the Trump administration, or something like that. I mean, it hasn't come into my writing in any direct way, because the way it's affected me is I feel like we had to do something, and I don't know what your experience is, but there are things to be done, supporting with money, if nothing else, lawyers who are helping the people being picked up by ICE. Mm-hmm. It's a powerful thing to do. Turns out I started going to neighborhood meetings of people who are trying to address these issues in our culture. And it turns out that the local sheriff's office in the county where I live is getting $162 a night for putting in jail the people that the Immigration Service picks up.
Yeah.
And that it's so overcrowded in the women's jail in Contra Costa County, right next to one of the great universities in the world, that they give women plastic bags for toilets. And $162 a night, they jail people from all over Northern California, Nevada, and the Bay Area, brings in about $3 or $4 million a year, which lowers my property taxes. So it turns out, when you lift up a rock and say, who are the bad guys? It's you. Yeah. Doing this stuff. So I think there are things you can do. My wife does something simple. She moans at gas pumps. Whenever she's pumping gas, she just stands there and goes, oh, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, pipelines. It's just a little thing. It dismays everyone in the gas station. And I would personally prefer she didn't do it because it's embarrassing. But on the other hand, taking the position that what we really need to do in this climate is do something.
Okay.
Do something. Get uncomfortable and do something, because the situation is appalling.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to end. But thank you, both of you, so much for coming tonight. And thank you. Yeah.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.